Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful, live. Welcome to the stage, Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
This is the 100th episode of Reasons to be Cheerful, and we are at Abbey Road Studio.
Good whooping, good whooping.
It's that exciting.
It is exciting.
Yeah. Very kindly, Universal Music got in touch with us and said, would you like to do an episode from Abbey Road? And for me, I'm trying to think what the equivalent would be for you, because I'm such a huge music and specifically a Beatles fan. This is Mecca for me. This is the... I don't know. What was that restaurant where Tony Blair and Gordon Brown...
Granita. That's true. But it doesn't exist anymore, but that's really interesting. Yeah, that's good.
Or maybe...
Or that place I ate the bacon sandwich, maybe, you know.
Maybe less. If you had become Prime Minister, would you have had that place demolished?
Definitely. definitely. Granitas, I think, would be... I'm not sure you'd want to do a podcast live from Granitas. So.
No. Save that for the 200th episode.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's just incredible to be here. I don't know how many people who are with us tonight have been inside Studio 2 before, but it's extremely
Who's
rare.
Been inside Studio 2?
I think there's a few people who work here.
Yeah, right. Okay. So, it'd be bad if they hadn't been inside, actually.
But it's an incredible room. It's an incredible building. Abbey Road.
Give us a little bit of the old, because you're an aficionado.
So Abbey Road Studios has been open since 1931. Do you know who the first artist to play here was?
Bing Crosby.
Edward Elgar.
Really?
Yeah. So I think in the early days, they would record a lot of orchestras here. What is acknowledged to be the first British rock and roll record, which is Move It by Cliff Richard. That was recorded in Abbey Road. But it was 1962. The Beatles came here to perform their audition for George Martin. And these studios, and specifically this room, this was the home of the Beatles. This is where they did the lion's share of their work. Here's the thing that always surprises me about this place whenever I've been lucky enough to come here. There's just stuff lying around that should be in display cases.
Really?
Yeah, look, there's a piano over there at the back that the Beatles used, I think, on Fool on the Hill and Penny Lane and Numero. Wow. It's just there in the corner.
People might wander off and start trying to play it or something.
Do you want to?
No, I think I could, but not. But you could play it, maybe.
Yeah, but I mean, you could just, you know, if we could maybe try and hoik that out at the end of the night. I think anybody would notice.
I think they might notice. I think me and you walking down the road.
It would look suspicious, yeah. Wouldn't it? Yeah, a bit Chuckle Brothers-y.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so George Martin uses...
George Martin would be up there in the control room. The Beatles would be down here. They'd have their roadies, Neil and Mal, fetching things for them. But that incredible body of work that was recorded between 1962 and 1970, most of it was done in here. But it wasn't just the Beatles. Pink Floyd recorded a lot of their early stuff here. In more recent times, Florence the Machine, Adele, Oasis. It's a working studio. And this is...
Could be a tour guide. Can I just say, I never realized this about you. You could be, you've got the natural, you're a tour guide natural.
I could do with the work, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this can't keep going forever.
Maybe you could do like the House of Commons. Well, I don't know, actually, but maybe you could do like the House of Commons tour guide.
You once gave me a tour of the House of Commons.
That was terrible.
You were terrible.
It was embarrassing.
It was.
It was embarrassingly bad.
So who's that statue of? No idea.
Yeah, no, yeah. I know.
Yeah. So we should talk about what we're going to be talking about on this special episode.
We're going to be talking about music in schools and music education in schools, which I think is an incredibly important subject because not just because the kind of Lennon and McCartney of the future will, you know, either be produced or not produced, depending on whether there's music in schools, but because of all of the other benefits that musical education in schools has. And the truth is, I'm afraid music education in schools has been faring badly in the last few years. As we're going to hear, a combination of cuts and something called the EBAC, which has sort of downgraded subjects like music, I'm afraid has had a pretty bad effect. But the good news is that we've got answers, which is, you know, and definitely reasons to be cheerful. We're going to be talking to Jimmy Rotherham, who is a music, and honestly, this is an amazing story. He's a music coordinator at Feversham Primary Academy in Bradford, and he's going to be telling us what he has done, which is truly remarkable in terms of how he has facilitated the turnaround of a school. And Deborah Annetts, who's chief executive of the Incorporated Society of Musicians, and there are solutions out there.
And we're going to be joined by one of my favorite acts. She used to be in a band called Slow Club, and now she has cast that off and she has become Self-Esteem. It's Rebecca Lucy Taylor. Also, Katie Tunstall. And as a special treat, if my tour guiding skills weren't enough.
Which they were good.
But this man knows this place inside out. You mentioned his dad before, George Martin, who produced all those great Beatles records, and now he is the custodian of the Beatles catalogue, and he's overseen all the remixes and reissues of the Beatles stuff, and he's a very busy producer as well. I mean, it's amazing that he's got time for us tonight, but he most recently did the soundtrack to Rocket Man. Giles Martin is going to be joining us later. So I thought, with this being in this iconic musical location, I could ask you about the first record you ever bought. And then I sort of panicked. Has Ed ever bought a record?
Yeah,
is what I wondered.
I think I'm sure I did. Trying to remember, what's the first record you ever bought?
I remember being taken to a record shop in Macclesfield called BJ's and ordering a record, Video Killed the Radio Star.
I think it might have been Pink Floyd, actually.
That's too cool for you. That doesn't ring true with me.
See, I'm just making it up.
It sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah, you think it might be like David Cameron's support for Aston Villa or West Ham or whatever it was.
When you did Desert Island Discs, did you pick those songs yourself or did you get a little help with them?
I got some help. Right. Please welcome onto the stage Deborah Annetts and Jimmy Rotherham. So, Deborah, why don't we start with you? Tell us a little bit about the Incorporated Society of Musicians and what you do in relation to this issue.
Right. We've been going for a very long time, since 1882. And one of our founders was actually Edward Elgar.
Right.
So it's amazing to be here in the space of our, you know, the person who set us up, which is wonderful. And since 1882, we have been looking after the interests of professional musicians, campaigning for better terms and conditions, because most musicians get exploited terribly and they really need all of our protection and support. But we've also been talking a lot since then around music education, because right from the get-go, it was pretty grim. It got a bit better through most of the 20th century, and then it kind of took a nosedive around 2010.
Just tell us a little bit, for those who don't know, about how music education works in the UK in terms of what, or rather in England maybe, about in schools. I mean, what's the... what are the sort of requirements in schools? What's compulsory? What's optional and so on?
Okay, so we've got this thing called the national curriculum, which all state schools theoretically have got to follow. But then the academies were set up and the academies were told that they didn't have to follow the national curriculum. And what that has meant is that 72% of secondary schools are now academies, and a huge number of them have basically given up on the national curriculum, as have many primary schools. And music is part of the national curriculum. So if your school isn't obliged to follow it because it's now an academy, chances are it may disappear. And what we're seeing at Key Stage 3, as it's called, so it's the 12 to 14-year-olds in secondary schools, the majority of those are no longer studying music. And 50% of primary schools have lost their music as well.
And that's because of cuts, is it?
Cuts, but mainly, I'm afraid, it's the driver of the academies and also something called the EBAC, which I hope we're going to talk about, because unfortunately, the impact of the EBAC is to remove creative subjects in our schools, because there isn't time for them, because everybody's doing triple science or French or geography, huge amounts of geography, maths and English and all the rest of it.
And the EBAC is sort of about a core series of subjects which you have to do, and basically art subjects aren't in the... not in the core.
That's right. So back in 2010, when this idea came out of the Conservative government, music was there. In the first interview with Michael Gove, music was there. And then the second interview, it had disappeared. And it's been kind of falling through the cracks ever since, which has caused huge trauma in relation to what's going on in our secondary schools. You know, music teachers losing their jobs. Very often a music department is now just one teacher in a secondary school, and being timetabled off. So definitely within Key Stage 3, you may only get one music lesson every term if you're lucky.
And can we talk a little bit about why it's important beyond just creating another Lennon McCartney and it being important to the economy?
Important.
That is important. But so more broadly, why is music so important?
Well, I think music is part of being a human being, you know? If you go back to the beginning of time, the dawn of time, caveman was in his cave drawing pictures of musical instruments, you know? And Plato, you know, the great god Plato, talked about music being absolutely fundamental to education. So it was going really well, you know, for a lot of ancient Greeks, getting, you know, to grips with music. And then we have, through recent times, government policy has very much been embarking on this knowledge-focused way of schooling, which is basically sticking as much education in terms of facts and knowledge and content into children's heads.
Young people doing music GCSEs has fallen. I mean, pretty, it's like something like 1 in 20 or less.
That's right. So since 2014, music GCSE has dropped 17%. Creative subjects as a whole have dropped 18%.
And there is, just before we come to Jimmy, there is a sort of public-private issue here, which is, I think, your State of the Nation report showed that 85% of independent schools say they have a school orchestra, only 32% of state schools. So
Absolutely. There's
a big divide here.
There's a huge divide. So if you think about music as being core to being a human being, and you really do want all children to be exposed to it, there's something fundamentally unfair about Eton having 100 visiting music teachers.
100.
100. That's outside of the music department, but 100 visiting music teachers in addition to that school department of music.
Right.
Whereas in most state schools, there's virtually nothing. So in terms of diversity and what the music industry is going to look like in the future, there is a real problem there that we're just going to have posh kids. Nothing against posh kids, but actually talent resides in anybody. It's not about class.
So let's turn to Jimmy. You were the music coordinator, as I said in the introduction, at Feversham Primary Academy in Bradford. I mean, Jimmy, it's an extraordinary story. I mean, tell us sort of how you came to teach there and then what's happened?
It is an extraordinary story, and I can't quite believe it myself. I'd actually given up teaching about 7 years ago. I was given more and more responsibilities, fewer and fewer hours to do it in, and that's a common experience for a lot of music teachers in school.
In a sixth form college.
Yeah. They offered voluntary redundancies. I bit their hand off, and I decided to try and just be a professional musician for a while. I started to read about the incredible effects of music education on young children, and I started to do a bit of supply teaching in primary schools, and I landed at Feversham on supply, and I was just doing one afternoon a week. And it was quite typical of a lot of primary schools. I was doing just year 5 and 6, so there's no development. It was for the musical children rather than the non-musical children didn't get it. Luckily, there was a new head teacher who's from a Sufi Muslim background. And for him, music's one of the last connections we have to the spiritual in a secular society. Whereas for me, it was about the incredible effects. For example, neuroscience studies have shown that learning music at an early age promotes structural and functional changes in the brain. It helps children with a range of conditions like dyslexia. I've done some work with Katie Overy from Edinburgh University, who's shown that dyslexic children often struggle with rhythmic activities. And actually, if you can fix the rhythmic activities, it will have a positive effect on the literacy. So I read lots of research like this and became very passionate about working with children as young as possible, because I think that's where it makes the biggest difference. And I told all this to the head teacher, who said, brilliant, I want to support it as much as possible. And he just said yes to everything I asked for. So we went from that situation to being really well stocked with instruments. I was given all the training I wanted to get. So I went to get Kadai training and Dalcroze.
Where are we in the 6-year journey?
We were in special measures. We'd been in special measures for about 100 years before that. We were founded in 1874. Right. And we've basically been a failing school all of that time. It's in an area of Bradford, which is 98% Pakistani Muslim, and also 98% of the children don't speak English as a first language. As I say, we're a failing school in special measures, and then the more music we did, the more we saw the benefits.
How much music do you now do in the school?
We're now doing up to 6 or 7 hours a week for every single child that wants it.
Six or 7 hours a week?
Yeah, as an offer. The core offer is about 3 hours, but they can opt into lots of extra things.
Lots of them take it up?
Yeah, huge numbers for choirs and drumming groups and things like that, plus a really strong core offer of music.
And what have the results been?
Our results just went through the roof, absolutely through the roof. We were getting better SATS results than the private schools near us. We're in the top 1% of schools in the country for pupil progress now. And this is another really powerful thing. If you're working with children who are learning English as an additional language, again, lots of studies have shown that it's incredibly powerful in teaching them the language skills that they need, especially through singing. It's really, really powerful.
So you've seen an absolute transformation in the school.
It's been miraculous. And then when you see that with the children in my school, why isn't every child getting that? My story shouldn't be a story. It's someone who's been given the opportunity to teach music and supported, and the children will flourish.
And you were one of the shortlisted for the top 50 for the 2019 Global Teacher Prize as a result of what you've done.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds extraordinary. Deborah, sort of, what do we learn quite a lot from this, don't we?
We do. I mean, actually, there's a huge amount of academic research out there, which absolutely underscores everything that Jimmy says. I mean, Jimmy's tale is very, very powerful, but there is stacks of research which says the same thing. There is something about music which transforms children. I think partly because it's a lot of fun. Actually, if it's done well, which Jimmy does, it's a lot of fun. And that's about, you know, kind of using your body, getting the rhythm, hearing the sounds, using Kadai, etc., when you're very, very young. And then you develop your ear. And once you've developed your ear, you can go absolutely anywhere.
Now, you mentioned the Kodai. Mm-hmm. That is the method, correct?
Yeah.
Do you want to say something about the Kodai method?
It's not exactly a method. It's right. more seen as an approach because it's not a dictated methodology where one guy has said, this is what you will do. Yeah. It's about...
I learned the violin by the Suzuki method.
Oh, okay. Did you?
Yeah.
And how did you find that?
I was terrible at the violin, but I wasn't a great advert for the Suzuki method.
What does one of your music lessons typically look like?
Nothing like what you'd expect a music lesson to look like. Lots of children running around, playing games, playing clapping games. But actually through playing those, the games serve two functions. One of them is in music, we have to repeat things over and over and over again. And if you make it into games, it reverses that dynamic of the music teacher having to say, right, do it again. And all the children go, oh, we've done it 79 times. It completely reverses that. So it's the children saying, can we do it again? Can we do it again? Can we do it again? And it's the other very important aspect of the games is that they will actually learn music through embodied cognition. So we might be learning about three pitches. We will have the high pitch here, we'll have the middle pitch here, we'll have the low pitch here, and we'll play games that cement those that understanding of music through the games. And quite often when you've played those games, you can then move the children onto pianos and instruments, and they can play it all. You don't need to spend any time with them showing them where the notes are. They just go and play it. Yeah. And the same with reading music and writing music. And it's about developing the child holistically in terms of music, but also developing the child holistically in terms of the whole child. So we're looking to develop their language, their social skills, and the social dynamic. That element of the games is incredibly important.
And how common is this teaching method in schools and...
Well, unfortunately, an awful lot of primary schools have no music. You know, this is the problem because head teachers are very conscious of the targets that they have to meet, like SATs. And we've now got all the baseline assessment coming in as well. And what that means is that an awful lot of head teachers are really focusing on maths and English and science. So things like painting and music and all the good stuff that I did when I was at primary school has disappeared in an awful lot of places. So your school is very lucky to have you and to have a really insightful head teacher. But most schools are not like that.
So it's just down to the fact, you know, you're lucky enough to have a school with a headmaster.
Also brave and right. values music. Because I think the problem with all these accountability measures which have come out from the Department for Education, they have actually taken autonomy away from the head teachers instead of actually empowering them.
And the teachers as well.
And the teachers, yeah. And so it's very, very prescriptive education policy. And that's why we see such dominance around the accountability measures, combined with, of course, the funding issue and the fact that we've got the academy change.
But Jimmy, you're also saying you're a trained musician. Mm. Whereas sometimes people aren't taught by people who are trained musicians.
In primary schools, I think there's a particular acute issue around training because most people delivering music in primary schools are either trained as a secondary music teacher, so they don't really understand how they're trained to teach 12 to 18-year-olds. They don't know how to teach 5-year-olds. And I was the same when I started, and right. I recognised that I needed to learn child-friendly approaches. So they're either secondary trained music teachers or the non-music specialists, general class teachers. And at the moment, general class teachers are given between something like 1 and 6 hours a week on the entire, sorry, not a week.
No,
on,
the year.
Sorry, on their entire PGCE. Yeah. So in the entire year, they'll do maybe 4 or 5 hours of music. Yeah. And then they're expected to go and deliver it in an outstanding way.
Where is great? Finland, is that right?
Finland is good.
That's a surprise.
It's obviously a long way away.
Yeah.
And interestingly, in times gone past in the Far East, places like China and Singapore were really, really focused on things like knowledge-based education. But then they realized that if they really wanted to have strong, sustainable economies, they needed to make sure that there was lots of creativity coming through their education system. So they've kind of moved increasingly into creative education, whilst we've been moving in the opposite direction. And I think it's because they understand that one of the big things about the fourth industrial revolution is making sure that we can create intellectual property that we can then exploit. So they're all ahead of the curve, and we're somewhere back in the 20th century.
If you look at what business is demanding now, that so Paul Dreschler, who was the head of the CBI, was saying we need creative, out-of-the-box thinkers in for the new AI revolution. And even companies like Barclays Bank are saying we need more creative, we need more creativity for the people who are coming to work for us.
And it's even worse than that, because I don't know if you saw that recent report from the Edge Foundation, but they were, surgeons are saying that the students who turn up on their courses to learn how to cut you up and then sew you up, they don't have the dexterous skills, you know, the manual dexterity to sew you up. So they've had So they've had to bring in seamstresses to show people how to sew. I know this is really scary stuff.
Right.
Also, there was a guy, a surgeon, who started playing the cello to give him that fine motor skills.
So all of our manual dexterity that comes through the creative subjects is no longer there. So it has all kinds of implications.
Got a few minutes for audience questions. Anyone want to talk about their experience of music education in schools? Ask any questions.
My name's Everton Nelson.
Hi.
So I just wanted to explain my experience of the studio here, Abbey Road. So I led the soundtrack for Black Panther that was recorded in Studio One. Also for Captain America. I was taught peripatetically in Birmingham. I don't like to speak out publicly normally. Just hearing all these stories of what you've discussed tonight, this really speaks to me. And I just want to sort of say what I had as an experience as a child, my parents didn't have to pay for anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If now I've got a 16-year-old daughter, for her to have the same experience, I have to pay through the nose for that. In terms of my experience here at the studio and everything else, how would that work nowadays to
Very
give
good
the
question.
Same experience, to give me the chance now to be able to lead Hollywood films? What would you say to someone that's now 15?
Good question.
This is what you need to do.
Absolutely. So I went through the Perry system as well. So I learned...
What the system is.
Perry system. Okay, so it's being taught by a peripatetic teacher.
Right.
Who comes in from what was then, I suspect, the music service, and was absolutely free. But now, because of funding pressures, if you want to learn an instrument in a school, chances are you're going to have to pay for it. Your parent is going to have to pay for it. Chances are it's going to be extracurricular. So that immediately puts a pressure on lower income families.
I mean, I think I'm right in saying, sorry to interrupt, but 89% of families have to make a personal
Absolutely.
Contribution.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because the music education hubs are not properly funded. And indeed, at the moment, there is no financial settlement for them from next March.
Right.
So we are potentially looking at thousands and thousands of peripatetic teachers losing their jobs. So that, you know, you won't even be able to pay for it because the hub system will have crashed.
Jimmy?
I'm really glad you brought that up because it is a huge social justice issue. And we mentioned before that children in private schools, 52% of private schools have a bespoke concert hall. And a study by the Musicians Union showed that if you've got an income of less than 28,000, the likelihood is your children are not going to get any music education lessons. It's just not an option for you at all. So if we don't make it happen in schools, in the mainstream lessons, not as an add-on.
Absolutely.
Unless we do that, we are creating a huge inequality in our society because the children in the private schools are getting all of these benefits we talked about earlier, and in the state school children are not.
So counterproductive for the country.
Yeah,
I mean, we punch above our weight.
Absolutely. So in terms of GDP, the music industry produces 4.5 billion a year. In terms of creative industries as a whole, it's about 100 billion, which is the same value as the construction industry or the banking sector. So it is madness.
Yes.
So you talked about how the school moved up the league table. I wonder if you could expand a bit more on that. And I was wondering whether the passion that the children found for music then improved their passion for school education in general and other subjects.
Hi, my name's Matt. I just wanted to wonder what your thoughts are where parents who send their kids to private school seem to value music a great deal. Those schools put it way up their agenda. But yet the government of the last few years has downgraded its importance. And that seems like a weird contradiction. I'm just wondering what your thoughts on that were.
I think it's the, Deborah was talking about the high stakes accountability of maths and English in certainly in primary schools where I work. That's all that matters in the league tables and in the, you know, whether the head teacher's going to keep their job or not. And it takes, like you were saying, it takes a very, very brave head teacher to say, I don't care about that. And we're going to give these children the education that they need.
What about, you know, what's it done to the overall academic achievement, etc.?
Yeah, so, I mean, the statistics speak for themselves. I mean, attendance is up from 92% to 98%. The children are much happier. You can see it going around school. A good music program in a school can make school a really fun, thrilling, exciting place to go to. And that's what our school's like. If you just came in, just the atmosphere is absolutely incredible.
But when you said top 1% for progress, is that in music?
No, that's
the more
top
generally.
1% in all subjects. So, well, English and maths, basically. Mm. But I mean, there's... I mentioned
so it's obviously had a knock-on effect. I mean, that's the big change has been...
Yeah.
I mean, you had a new head teacher and all that, but obviously this has contributed to it.
We know that rhythmic activities improve reading ability and spelling ability. We know that and a lot of music activities involves quick numeracy skills as well, rapid numeracy skills. You're doing all kinds of things like rapid auditory processing, which is using the same parts of your brain that you use for speech and language. We've got autistic children in the school who I know for a fact would not speak if they didn't sing. They come to music lessons, they sing the heart out. Before they speak, and then over weeks we managed to turn that speaking into singing. So it's vitally important for every single child in that school. It's not just the musicians and the musically talented, it is for them as well, but it's for that little child who might feel like they're not very good at maths and English, and that's all they get in schools. Can you imagine being innumerate and having dyslexia? And you might be the best at football, you might be the best at music, you might be the best at drama, public speaking, all these things that you're not getting to do. So loads of children are feeling like failures in their schools. It's having
and
a
it's storing up problems with mental health.
Hugely.
And just coming back to that question about public schools, I mean, it is a bit of a conundrum because public schools use music as a way of getting children in. It's a marketing tool because they know parents really value it. And recent research from Ofsted found that 68% of parents didn't believe their children were getting enough music in school. So parents want it.
And I mean, you know, just I don't want to put you in the mind of Nick Gibb, the schools minister, or Michael Gibb, but I mean, why?
Why?
I think that was the question in a way.
Yeah. I think it, I mean, I don't want to get too kind of into knocking the DfE, but I do think this is about importing an ideology from America. It's come from America.
Right.
And it's about making sure that all of our kids' heads are filled with the same stuff in order to ensure that there is something called cultural literacy. And the things that have been selected are the things that basically were back in the 1904 school regulations, only they had art then, and they've dropped that since 1904. So it's very much about shifting the entire way that education works. So it's about facts rather than problem solving and creativity. And it's not based on the individual needs of the child. It's based very much on trying to get to a communal way of thinking and being. And I think that is profoundly troubling because it means it's taking away the ability to think. And more than anything, as a child, you need to learn how to think.
Oh, hi, my name's Steve. I just wanted to give a tiny flavour on something, which is at secondary schools, when you talk about the EBAC, the thing that you also want to be aware of is that English and maths are double weighted. So when they talk about the best eight, English and maths are double weighted, which means that from a school standpoint, I'm not saying it is more important, but actually, effectively for league tables and all that kind of thing, it becomes more important.
Absolutely.
And one of the first...
It's like playing a Joker on It's a Knockout.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the first... that's a very good way of putting it, I suppose.
Sorry.
One of the first sort of academy chains that did that, they actually shifted to do English and maths every day. So you had to, you went to 5 hours a week English, 5 hours a week of maths. Mm. So therefore, something had to give. And if you're only having to teach eight subjects, the arts went. And what they did curriculum-wise is they actually put all the arts subjects in the same option box.
That's right.
Which means that kids then couldn't select more than one.
Do you teach?
I used to, yeah, but not... I used to teach maths.
So it's a high-class audience, this audience. yes.
Hi, I'm Roz. Just wanted to pick up on something that Deborah mentioned about problem-solving skills. I work in a university, and we're hearing from a lot of employers that graduates leaving university aren't coming with the skills for not just learning or knowledge about their one specific subject, but the skills to learn. And that's the kind of thing that I've been lucky enough to learn with music, and the problem solving ability, and not just knowing your subject, but knowing how to solve a problem along with other people from different disciplines is massively lacking. And that's something
you
we have
did
to pick
music
up.
In school.
I did. Yeah, I did music in school, GCSE and A-level. Yeah.
And what do you do now? Sorry.
I work in the university library.
Right.
Running technology events for
but
students.
It's really helped staff. You.
Yeah, it really has. But what we're hearing from employers is that that's just not a skill that is coming through. And it seems like we're going to be missing a few generations. Even if we solve the problem now, it's still going to be lacking for them.
Great point. And there were two, I think there were two hands, were there? One hand.
I had a question about if we're kind of seeing the success in your school within the current restraints that are kind of imposed on primary schools, how do we take what you've learned and how you've managed to succeed even within that system and spread and scale that to other primary schools or other secondary schools and kind of working within those constraints and seeing the successes that you're seeing?
Good. Well, that's a good... And do you want to ask your... I think it fits into the Jeffocracy, doesn't it?
Yeah, so we have a thing on the podcast where I am installed as some kind of benign ruler of the country, if not the world. I'm very, very hands-off. So if I was just to delegate and make you some kind of joint minister for education and minister for culture, what is the thing that you would do?
And maybe you can answer the sort of spreading the practice. I mean, that's really... Yeah. It's in a way, I think what will occur to lots of people is how do you get Jimmy to... exist in every school.
Well, I mean, we did talk about cloning Jimmy before the program, but I think we need to clone his head teacher as well, because it does come down to the head teacher being brave. But I would also just mention academy chains, because an awful lot of schools now within academy chains, the policy is coming from the chief executive of that trust, and the head teacher no longer has the power to set what goes on in their schools. And we're hearing from academy chains that they're pushing music out of their schools, and they're also looking for unqualified music
but
teachers.
Isn't Steve's point right? Is it Steve? Yeah, his point right, which is if you change the sort of it's a knockout sort of, you know, business and the way it's, I mean, you could immediately have an effect.
Absolutely. I mean, this comes back again and again to the pernicious impact of the EBAC. And we run a campaign called Back for the Future. You'll find it out there on the internet. It's got hundreds and hundreds. I think it's got 45,000 supporters. And we've generated Westminster Hall debates as a result of it. And I know it seems like a really uphill struggle, but if you care about music education, you have to make your voice vocal.
Really good.
Yeah, I'm disqualified from being education secretary because I've worked in education. So that's the,
that's very true. Yeah. That is very true.
Music should be recognised as vitally important for the development of all children, for their academic progress, for their well-being, for their mental health. But I think there needs to be a shift in thinking to recognise that it's just as important a subject as maths and English, and we need child-friendly pedagogy, which allows children to learn in a way that suits them. The typical thing of being most people's memories of being of music lessons in school is your teacher giving you something that you don't understand, and then telling you off for every mistake you make. It's no wonder so few people call themselves musicians. We should all be calling ourselves musicians. We're all musical. Babies are all musical. Start them teaching.
Even me.
Even you.
I went to karaoke with Ed, and he did a very good rendition of Je Ne Regrette Rien.
I think you're being very nice.
But also, I've got the image in my head.
Yeah.
But school.
I can't get it out of my head. I'm getting the tapes destroyed, actually.
So we need much more sustained training for the people who are going to be delivering this, whether they be secondary music teachers who need to learn how to teach it in primary schools or whether they be generalist class teachers.
Can I just add one thing I would like to do if I were, you know, kind of in charge of everything? I would send the entire cabinet back to secondary school and force them to do the EBAC.
Yeah.
Without any creative subjects whatsoever.
So we just send the cabinet back to secondary school and leave it there?
Yeah.
Well, look, I think it's incredibly inspiring. I mean, we should also say that, you know, this is a big interest of Universal Music, which is one of the reasons that we've been talking about it today. But I think it's an interest of everyone. I think you've been absolutely brilliant. I think it's really, both of you, really, really inspiring. I think we need to sort of, you know, to rise up and, absolutely, you know, change this.
Absolutely.
Because I think it's so important for every child in this country and so important for the future of the country. Deborah Netz, Jimmy Rotherham, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Normally being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Let's welcome onto the stage for a chat Rebecca Lucy Taylor, Giles Martin, and Katie Tunstall. Thank you all for coming tonight. What was music education like at school for you then?
Really vital. That's like really touched a nerve with me, because I had a teacher called Mr. Wright who was, if I'd not had him, my life would be completely different, because I was dreadful at maths, like hysterical in maths, crying because I couldn't do it. And my respite from science and all that sort of thing was, I got to play the drums and I got to sing in choirs and things. And when I was leaving school, it was like, you've got to go to uni. And I was like, okay, I'll go and do English Lit. But I shouldn't have done that, and I didn't. And it took a lot of like bravery to choose to go and do music. And I had a really beautiful education based around the music department.
Was it just lucky?
I'm just lucky. There was two teachers there that were, and they would stay. Now when I think about it, they stayed behind every night to help me learn to singing.
Really interesting.
And we did show after show, and they cared about how we were, and they weren't getting paid for that. Like, I have such a similar thing of like, I was lucky.
How about you, Katie?
Yeah, I was the same. Just, it wasn't a question of whether you'd have music at school or not. It's a given. We had a music department. There was a piano, there was instruments. We were asked. So I started piano lessons actually outside of school. I can't remember if there were piano lessons. It's not sure, but I started at 4. I was like, you know, hassling my parents to start those lessons really young. So I started outside of school, but the school music department was phenomenal. I started flute lessons, I think at 10 or 11 or something. Ended up doing, music into my hires, ended up studying music at college. Totally intrinsic part of not just my education, but my sanity. And since, you know, going through that education system, I've seen various different examples of how it's working within schools. And the one thing that I've really noticed when I see younger kids engaging in music education is they're venting. A lot of the time, they're emotionally venting in a music lesson or in a drama lesson. There's a lot of drama, you know? But I think that all of these cognitive skills are essential in a, being a well-rounded emotional human being, but also, you know, from the beginning of school at 4 or 5 years old up until you're 18, this is an incredibly emotionally taxing time as a human being. And the other thing that you're not getting to taught really within the current school curriculum and never really have is how to express yourself, how to tell people how you feel. Yeah. You're just told what you should know, how you should use that,
yeah,
what you should be doing. No one's actually telling you. I wish at school I'd been taught how to express being angry about something, but without being out of control. And music, I think, is a really, really important way of kids to get some stuff out of their system and express themselves in terms of how they feel.
Charles, I'm imagining it's slightly different for you because by the time you were born, your dad is this extremely successful figure in the music industry. So is music just something you took for granted in your house? Or was it the other way? You never heard a note of it?
Well, I've been established right now, a posh kid. So I did have, it was different. I mean, my father being a, you know, a renowned musician, he was dead against me doing music. I don't know why. He thought I should get a proper job. He met musicians. He led a lot of them. But it's funny. I went from a little farming school to a posh boarding school, a boys' public school. And, I had a West Country accent, which is hard to believe, but I had a slightly West Country accent, spoke a bit like that. And I went to the school and I was mercilessly bullied for a year. And I really didn't know where to go because it's funny. You're locked away. But because it was a private school, we had piano rooms and I went to piano rooms. And that's right. That was where I basically escaped to. And exactly what Katie's saying. And I say this to parents of kids who ask about music is like, an instrument has to become your friend. It has to become something you can talk to. And it was where I would go. And if you don't have that as a child, if you don't have that outlet, if you can't, you know, I was like dyspraxic. You know, I had difficulty looking at blackboard and writing things down, things like that. And as soon as I got into learning chord structures, harmonics, all this stuff, I became good at physics and good at maths because they're linked together. And that's the thing about people write off musicians as it's another world, another planet, but it's the heartbeat of our lives and the way frequencies interact with each other is what happens around the planet every day, and that's music. And so I was incredibly lucky, and I don't know what would happen if I hadn't have had that. So, you know, almost, you know, from the other way looking in, it was fundamental to me to have an instrument nearby.
Can we talk a little bit about this place? So Katie, how is it different to other studios? Because it just smells different. It feels different when you walk in this place. You get a sense of the history. What is it compared to other places that you've worked around the world?
Well, the thing that is obvious probably for everyone is connected to what you said, Daz, which is that it smells of science in here. If my dad was a physicist and he would take us to his lab all the time as kids and we'd play with all these, you weren't meant to touch anything. We would play with all this equipment. It'd all be, you know, warm wires and warm machines whirring and specially treated rooms to create the right environment. And it smells the same as Abbey Road. Other studios don't smell like this, by the way. This is definitely special, but it's because it's so old. And it's because it, I think, understands. It doesn't need to revamp. It doesn't need to, you know, redecorate. This is why it's so good. And, you know, very old instruments as well. But, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, 50s, when it was all burgeoning recording studios, The recording engineers did wear lab coats. They wore white coats because they were scientists. And musicians making records, there is science involved all the time in what they're doing. And even if you don't understand the academic science of it, as a musician, when you're writing songs, I mean, you know this, sometimes you'll write something and it makes you cry. Sometimes you'll do something in a key and you're like, I don't like it. And then you change the key and you go, whoa, boom, you feel it. There's a frequency communication with music. And I think that there's a respect of not the new and the shiny and the modern and the contemporary and renewing, renewing, renewing in here. There's a respect of work rather than stuff. And I really like that about here.
Charles, do you wish they'd give you a white lab coat? Have you asked for one?
Well, I would, but producers wore suits.
Oh, so there was a dress code hierarchy.
My dad would wear a suit and tie, and engineers wear lab coats. And I mean, when the, you know, we're in Studio 2 now, and you know, we're facing the door the Beatles came through, and my father had been upstairs and on the window looking down. It's unusual. The studio is on two floors, and the band wasn't allowed upstairs. The people in the lab coats would be up there. They'd come in, and they only if they were invited, but they'd be able to listen to. But going back, my father started here. They would have the guys with lab coats. He would be in this room, and his job was to work out how much music you could fit into a disc. And they would drop a weight from the ceiling and engrave a record. And the guys in lab coats would be able to tell it was a good recording just purely by looking at the record, because they couldn't play it back. It would have to be printed, and then 3 days later it would come back. And you're absolutely right. I think, you know, turning things on its head, I think you can make physics and maths more interesting to kids by applying music to them. You can apply art and English. We are too rigid in the way we educate our kids, and it doesn't let kids who think differently in to the curriculum.
It kind of feels a bit deliberate, though, doesn't it? I mean, it's not a coincidence that the education system is creating a non-thinking workforce. People who make creative art are often rebelling, bucking against trends, asking for change, pushing towards things being different, and usually upsetting the status quo. So it's pretty sinister, I think, actually, that this is happening.
I mean, there is a sort of paradox here, though, isn't there? Which, just thinking about it, I think I'm right in saying that 1 in 8 albums sold worldwide are by UK artists. So
5 of the top 10 touring acts in the world are from the UK.
So we sort of punch massively above our weight, yeah. You know, to be heavy about it. It's kind of good for capitalism, this. In other words, you know, it sells records and all that. And yet something about it is sort of, you know, you've got in the school system, as we've heard, there's something deeply ideological about it, because it's like, why, you know, yeah. if this is like something we were crap at as a country, you'd say, well, okay, not something that we're good at as a country, you know, you'd still say we should be encouraging it, but it's sort of even doubly sort of bizarre. I mean, it's intrinsically the right thing to do, but it's also even a good thing to do from the point of view just simply the bottom line.
Be able to think differently and everyone having different skill sets and everyone having to be able to communicate differently is a good thing. I mean, if you come from a music background or an arts background or a science background and you put them in a room together, they're going to do good things. If everyone's in the same background, and the most interesting, I've done video games. The most interesting video game programmers are clarinet, you know, play the clarinet really well. You know, there's a mix with everything. And I think open-mindedness is a great thing to teach for schools.
It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. Why not support something that is good for the economy, good for mental health, good for societal health? I basically spent my 20s dodging the system to get 52 quid a week and get my housing benefit paid. I got a deal at 29, and I ended up paying millions of pounds in tax that I never would have earned if I hadn't pursued life as a musician. But it was bloody hard to get there. There was no support whatsoever to do it professionally. And I've paid back countless more pounds than I would have done if I'd done anything else.
I don't think people think of, and certainly, you know, in my people didn't think of the music industry, and even, you know, my dad and his experience, but people forget about the everything surrounding the music industry. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's powered by, you know, you guys go on tour. Think about how many people, you know, from t-shirt manufacturers to people doing monitors, sound, promotion, ticket sales, buying tickets. It's a big industry.
Maybe it's because I've got current events on my mind, but I mean, you do sort of begin to wonder whether it's just to do with whether you want to live in the early 20th century or the 21st century. And you know, if you think everything was better sort of 50 or 100 years ago when you people were taught in a much less, you know, with a totally different set of requirements for what's needed, I fear. But anyway, it's got to change.
The one thing I wanted to add as well is that I talk a lot, I'm sure you do as well, Rebecca, but talk a lot to people after shows, and the overwhelming message that you get from fans is that song got me through this.
Exactly.
Right.
And without that, I mean, you just hear the most unbelievable stories of hardship, and it's not Prozac getting people through. It's music a lot of the time. And my God, that's a better way to get through something than drugs, mm-hmm. you know, or booze or whatever. But people, there's a medicinal quality mm-hmm. to music, not just as a listener, but as a participant and you don't have to be professional. A lot of people say to me, oh, I'm too old. And I just want to shake them. I'm like, you're never too old. What do you want to do? You don't want to be a professional musician, but to sit at home and just be able to play your favorite song mm-hmm. is medicine, mm-hmm. medicine.
You're saying I'm not too old, Casey.
You're not too old, Ed.
I would produce your album.
Far from it.
Yeah, pick that violin back up again.
Imagine that record, actually.
I'm quite traumatised by my time playing the violin. It got to the stage where basically, sorry, just sort of now, I'm going to sort of relive the trauma. Because it got to the stage where basically I said to my mum, so I started at the age of 7 playing the Suzuki method. I was living in America, and the only thing I remember about the Suzuki method was that you used to have to bow and say, Ohio gozai imasu, which was some kind of a greeting in Japanese, yeah. I guess. And then basically I was really bad at it. And then at the age of 11, I said to my mother, you know, I think I'm going to give up the violin, mum. And she said, oh, thank God for that.
You got time to do questions?
Yes.
Any questions for Katie or Rebecca or Giles?
So I guess a few of you mentioned that there isn't much support for aspiring musicians. And I guess I just wondered, going back to the Jeffocracy, what would you implement to provide that support?
Oh, good question.
Probably not even implement fact-based knowledge teaching in school until you're about 12.
Yeah.
I think it should all be creative thinking, creative arts, communication, developing as a decent human being.
That'd
be
good.
Once your brain is actually in a place to engage, be interested by and understand fact-based knowledge, then you bring that in. But I don't think that should be how you start your education.
And what about supporting people who are wanting to become musicians and are... That's in France, don't they, that we heard about on the podcast once?
Oh, yeah, you get a stipend.
Yeah, it's great if you're French. Yeah, you can tour forever.
why is that?
Because they help you financially.
Yeah, you do. You get a sort of certain... It's like a basic income you get if you're...
Daft Punk, for example.
Yeah.
They're a band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got
cool
that.
Cool guys over there. I would implement karaoke after work. I think that's a vibe. Because I noticed, like, you know, like laddie bands that are huge at festivals, like huge, obviously I'm involved in a lot of conversations about women being booked on festivals and the 50-50 thing and how impossible it is. But when you see what festivals are, they are men who don't get to sing in their lives, and when they can go and that's a release for them, and then it's freedom.
Was it Chelsea Dagger by the Fratellis?
Yes. But that's why the Fratellis will eternally make more money than me, no matter how much I think about what I'm making and how much I try, because I don't really know my point, but I think like implementing the singing is a therapy, and you
I guess now made to believe that it's just stupid and silly and embarrassing. And
I think
if you can't do it, you shouldn't do it.
If you think you can't, going back to your point, if you think you can't sing, you, as I do, you sort of think, oh, I don't, you know, they really want to try.
We're great at karaoke.
Yeah, right.
But why do you think that? You think that because you've been told that you can't sing.
Yeah, probably.
You've gone through a system that said, unless you reach this criteria, you can't sing. So get rid of that.
And it's been rewarded by TV shows and things like that. Like as much as I would like love that X Factor judging job, by the way,
yeah.
I think it's ruined it for everyone. I'm constantly asked by people who don't understand what I'm doing, when are you going to go on a talent show on the TV?
And it's so ironic. It's like it was called the X Factor, and it's like the thing that almost none of them have. Because it's like you go into a classroom in Britain and the boys are going to be shyer, but probably half the girls are quite good singers. Yeah. Right. Kids are quite good singers.
Right.
People are quite good singers. Yeah. We're human beings with larynxes. And we like music, so we listen to music and your ear becomes accustomed to music. But, you know, you look at the people. I love Tom Waits. I love Bob Dylan. Madonna's not a very good singer. Yeah. It's the X Factor that makes them amazing.
But also those all of those programs, what they sort of, they initially started to prove that anyone could be a massive star. And what they prove is that not everyone can be a massive star, obviously, because very few massive stars come out of those programs, if any. But what one thing it is, it shows that everyone should sing. Everyone, like exactly what you're saying. It's like when people go, you know, I'm too old to learn an instrument. I mean, you know, if we want to keep a family, maybe piano, not violin, would be a better idea. But it's true. Anyone can, you know, you can. It's just it's everyone's right to be able to sing or be able to play an instrument.
It is a good thing about the internet as well that you can now find a plethora of instrument lessons online for free. And I think that's definitely a really good leveler and should be really encouraged.
Maybe that should be my resolution.
Yeah.
Yeah, you should do it.
I'll think about what
it could be like that. Michelle, what's his name? When you learn, what's his name? The language guy. Because you learn with someone else who's on the recording. It could be learn an instrument with Ed.
Oh.
So you learn it at the same time. And the idea is that you do much better than the other person. So
we're going to go into partnership. We're going to go into partnership.
Yeah.
I think it's better than the make your own sandwich shop idea that I had as well.
Well, pick an instrument, give it 6 months, and then Giles will book in a recording session with you.
Right.
Okay. I think theremin, Giles. Can you imagine Ed playing a theremin?
Yeah, Ed's theremin album is one of the world is waiting for that.
You might get a Mercury now.
You'll explain to me that all that means later on. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming up and chatting to us. Rebecca Lucy Taylor from Self Esteem. Giles Martin and Katie Tunstall.
I would really like to thank Deborah Annetts and Jimmy Rotherham again, please. Big round of applause. I think we'd like to thank Universal Music.
Yeah, thank you so much for
Universal Music.
They gave us this studio. You can't usually come in here as a member of the public. I've tried on many occasions and been thwarted.
And I think we should say particularly to David Joseph, who runs Universal Music, who sort of listened to our podcast right at the early stages, and you know, this is what, and it led to this. So thank you to him.
Thank you to Universal.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.